Hello, and welcome to our next episode of Architecture and You, an informative collaboration between AIA Florida and the Florida Foundation for Architecture. I'm Rhonda Hammond, AIA, your host of the Voice of Florida Architecture. I'm here with Stephen Ruby, AIA, Chair of the Florida Foundation. Hi, Stephen, welcome.
Good morning, Rhonda. It's great to be with you again. We at Florida Foundation for Architecture are so pleased to be joining you in this series, Architecture and You. We feel it's promoting your mission to promote our profession to the public. Our vision for this series is to explore with our viewers the spaces we live in, work in, play in, and maybe even dream about. We'll be diving into a topic that affects all of us in so many ways. Even if we don't realize it, the value of architecture and the art and the architect in our everyday lives. When we think about architecture, we might picture famous buildings or eye-catching designs, but architecture is so much more than that. It shapes our communities, influences how we feel in the spaces we move through, and helps solve real world problems such as housing and climate change, safety and public health. Architects don't just design buildings, they imagine better ways for us to live together. Whether it's a local library, a hospital, a school, a park, or our own home. There's a lot of thought that goes into architecture, a lot of care, a lot of skill, and how we make these spaces real. Throughout this series, we'll be exploring examples of why architecture matters, what architects really do, and how good design can improve our lives in ways that we may not really expect. Today, we're having a conversation with Timothy McCarthy, AIA, RIBA, from Howerton in New York, Manhattan in New York. Tim and his firm specialize in hospitality design internationally. Tim is a leader in planning and designing solutions that create enduring places. His work in hospitality design focuses on innovation through designing for healthy living. His designs are transformative and result in memorable spaces and places. Tim's recent work includes the Naples Beach Club, a Four Seasons beach resort, the Old Naples Hotel, Jupiter Island Club, Half Moon in Jamaica, Ocean Forest at Sea Island, the Spa at the Inns of Aurora, and a global expansion of the Cabot Collection of hotels and resorts. Tim holds a master's degree from the University of Pennsylvania and a Bachelor of Architecture degree from the University of Notre Dame. He is a registered architect in many states and in the UK. He is a member of the American Institute of Architects, the Royal Institute of British Architects, and the Urban Land Institute. He has practiced in both US and the UK. Welcome, Tim, good morning. Thank you for being here today.
Stephen, thanks for that introduction. And Rhonda, thanks for the invitation to be with you all today.
Great.
You're most welcome.
Tim, I'd like to focus our discussion this morning on communicating to our audience what makes hotels and resorts special, memorable to its guests, inappropriate to its place. Your firm specializes in hospitality and resort projects internationally, as we said. Your portfolio is diverse in its scale, its type, its location, and its impact on the communities that you work in. I've experienced several of your projects, both here in the United States and offshore, and each one is different. There doesn't seem to be a signature style or character that we could identify your firm by. Why is that so?
Well, it comes out of a longstanding tradition of who we hire and who we're working with. And it's rooted in a way of thinking about architecture and placemaking that is perhaps a little bit different. We're not necessarily seeking that next architecture magazine cover. We're not necessarily seeking some of the things where a building is about, hey, look at me. I came in and I'm imposing a form or a shape or a way of living in a particular community. Instead, we're really focused on a process that looks to understand where we're working, who we're working with, and more importantly, who collectively we're delivering a new place to extend the legacy of an existing community, or begin to imagine a way of inhabiting a piece of land or a location around the globe, whether that's in the mountains, whether that's on the beaches, whether that's in the cities, whether that's rehabilitating existing buildings and imagining the next generation of ways that that particular facility can be used. And doing that in a way that then combines, I think uniquely in our practice, it combines the thinking of planners and landscape architects and interior designers alongside our architects, all in one office, working in an interdisciplinary way to think about what's a day in the life of this place. And if that's the leading question, our work becomes an outcome of those objectives, rather than imagining a form or a shape from the outset. Those early sketches are really about circulation, space making, understanding what it is that we need to protect and celebrate, and ways that our work can live alongside those pre-existing conditions.
Well, Tim, I've seen you your work in its early stages, and you do something that I think many architects may not do. You delve deeply into the research of a community when you step into it. You're coming from New York, and you come to New York and you come down for a town in Florida, and they're going to go, "Oh, this is a New Yorker trying to impose his will on us." But you don't do that. Why and how do you go about spending the time to do that research, and how do you get to the core of what the essence of the architectural heritage of a community?
It's research intensive, and it comes in a number of ways, shapes, and forms, Stephen. You know, one of the great aspects of the internet is you can do some pretty deep dives through desktop analysis, but ultimately there's no substitute for being on the ground, for looking people in the eye and understanding what's important to them. And so perhaps part of that for the audience today is to reflect on what a big part of our role as architects is, and that's of communication, being a communicator, walking into a room and listening actively, hearing 30, 50, 200 different points of view. Sometimes they're in concert with one another, sometimes they're in conflict with one another. But our role becomes that, not just of drawing, not just of working with structural engineers to make sure that a building's gonna stand up, but rather hearing all of the things that are going to create a great place for those different stakeholders, those different voices in the room. And as a result, we then do go away, we put pen to paper, we start to think about how all of those different influences are going to result in a singular solution. At the end of it, we do have to design and draw and permit and work through with all the relevant authorities a building. But when we come up with that design, we then think about how are we going to share this back to all of those different voices and stakeholders? How are we going to make sure that ultimately we gain consensus? We marry it together with the desktop research about history, about climate, culture, language, food, all the things in a resort setting that are going to attract people, not just for the first visit, but importantly for the communities where we're working, those second and third visits. How do we create a business sustainable thesis here that's rooted in a real celebration of the unique attributes of a place? So I actually had a couple of things that maybe regarding the kind of engagement with a community, I might just throw up on the screen to highlight some of these aspects regarding communication.
Sure.
So why don't I go ahead and introduce you to a project that we've been working on for a number of years. This is out on the West Coast, but we have a lot of great iPhone shots from the engagement with the community that I thought would be really worthwhile sharing, that we might end up needing to draw the building that is on screen. We might be working with civil engineers and landscape architects to think about the physical environment. But in this case, we had to first understand the community where we're working. So we're out on the peninsula in the San Francisco Bay Area. We're down in a community called Bell Haven, which is very near Palo Alto, Menlo Park that you see here on the map in the inset in the lower right. But in the upper left of the triangle was a longstanding community asset, the Oneida Harris Community Center. And it had a number of different programmatic requirements, but it was also reaching the end of its useful life and a need for reimagination. And so through a process of engagement with the community, we were able to ultimately derive a new site plan and deliver on that. But it started with great Saturday work sessions with the community, where we're thinking about pulling together images of aspirations. What might we be able to do if we were to reimagine this as a brand new facility? Taking notes, you can see here, post-it notes, and my colleagues engaging with all ages that you see reflected in these photographs. And then consolidating these in work after the meeting, coming back and sharing back to the community, okay, we heard all of these different things. Here are some common themes. Here then ultimately are ways to think about how an existing set of floor plans, which everybody has come to know and understands how to use and understands who they might interact with as they pass from point A to point B within a building, and start to imagine new sizes, new shapes, new relationships on the left-hand side. So whether that's focused on in this particular screen, the use that the senior citizens might have for the facility, but also at the other end of the demographic spectrum, other ways of engaging kids and the youth, to think about ways that we're engaging with technology and library and resources, and ultimately in concert with one another, then coming up with a new plan that is able to be delivered to the community, and do it in a way that combines it with smart decision making relative to the long-term operating costs for the community. And so in this instance, delivering a net zero building where we're able to take some of those constraints off of the community on a go-forward basis in terms of having to pay perpetually for energy and other things that it takes for the building to operate. We can focus those long-term resources on the people that are going to program the space and attract those community members here together. So I thought in terms of the context of our role as communicators, our role of thinking about the different requirements of different user groups, then working together with, in this instance, our internal landscape architecture team and interior design team to think comprehensively about ways that we can arrange space, choices we can make at a material level so that we're thinking about the LEED certification, the leadership in energy and environmental design, and thinking through ways that we're making smart choices about each one of these materials, imagining how it might be used during the day versus how it might be used during the evening, and ultimately then being able to deliver on a lot of those post-it notes to create a building and share back to the community the result of all of that public engagement, combined with the knowledge and history of the particular place.
Wonderful project, Tim. That kind of leads me into something I've been thinking, and I think we've had this discussion before. That community engagement process with the community was a one-on-one with the community. But you alluded to this earlier in your discussion. I know you're very successful at mitigating corporate image of your clients and your local architectural environment and character of an area, and the desires and needs of a community, sometimes offering diverse opinions. How do you go about navigating these conflicting visions and agendas in your project and gaining consensus?
A very fair question. Most of the work that we're doing is for private clients. And that's really a code word for they need a business plan. It needs to be rooted in economic success. And so in each instance, we're doing active meetings with our clients, perhaps out of the public eye, but understanding costs, understanding revenues, understanding ways that we can attract people to spend time in this place so that we can continue to invite public to engage with a hotel over many, many, many years, many, many decades. In several instances, we're working with long-term holders of assets, people who have been involved in a community in many instances for many decades and look to continue that legacy of what they've been able to contribute by engaging with us and imagining the next generation of an asset. And so while we do presentations to local community boards, to city councils, to design review boards, and we present everything from the architecture to how we're compliant with traffic and parking considerations, we're also working through in the background ways to marry that together with a business plan. And so that's the, I think, the corporate aspect of what you're touching on a little bit, that in each instance, these do need to have a business plan, that there are outcomes and success metrics tied to those aspects of the project in addition to placemaking. And so within our firm and within our business, we have a number of people who are able to think differently than just putting pen to paper. I touched a little bit on the people who are leading some of the communications. We have others who are focused on waterproofing, or others who are focused on deep energy modeling and analyses of the buildings and thinking about ways that buildings and facades can rotate and change so that we can eliminate some of the requirements for energy in the first instance just by having a passive building that incorporates some of these clever solutions for extended roofs and eaves that shade the windows and reduce how much sun actually gets into the building in the first place while still celebrating great views. We have all of those different experts in the business, but we also have a whole network of professionals that we engage with as we start to think about how do we run a business case analysis in parallel to a series of sketches and measuring square footages and reaching out to contractor partners who are able to provide up to the minute information relative to labor costs or material costs, thinking smartly about what's made domestically, what's made internationally. How do we incorporate all of those different aspects and ultimately come up with, again, back to that single solution that incorporates all these different influences. So that role of sitting in the middle, that hub in the middle of a wheel where we have spokes out to a whole number of different experts.
Yeah, I think one of the things that in my community there's a sensitivity to is architecture that is corporate architecture, that has corporate image. And you deal with major hospitality corporations. And it seems that your product never really, as I said, you can't find a signature style for your firm. I don't see a signature corporate style in what you're producing. Is it difficult to gear and to lead your clients maybe away from a corporate image?
I don't know that it is. I think most of the people who are walking through the front door for our firm and for our business are perhaps seeking the process more so than the finite outcome. Meaning we have many, many people who are either direct repeat customers and clients or one degree of separation, people who perhaps were early on in their career working with us because someone at their organization told them to. And then subsequent to that, after successfully delivering that project, perhaps they're in a position somewhere else to turn around and say, that's the type of process, that's the type of thinking that we need on a new opportunity. And therefore, let's go through and engage with their firm. Let's engage with a team that they might recommend inviting to the table. And out of that, we'll have something really, really unique. I think the parallel, you know, on the corporate and the operator side. So in the hospitality space, you'll often have an owner of the building, somebody who pays for the building. You'll have an operator who's really just the staff and the employees that make that place work on a day-to-day basis. And then you have us as consultants, a group of engineers and designers who are thinking about everything from interior design to lighting design to architectural design. And all of those different roles come with different expectations, but increasingly those operators are actively seeking things that are unique to a particular community. The old days, perhaps in the 80s and 90s, before globalization, before people are tremendously more mobile today than they were previously, there was a period in time where people wanted a consistent hotel and resort experience. They wanted that feeling of safety. They wanted that feeling of familiarity. And so the way that you arrived to a property was similar, whether you were in Asia or whether you were in the States. There was a way of arriving to the property. There was a way of getting escorted to your hotel room. There was a way of spending time at the pool. And I think increasingly those ways of thinking have broken down. And thankfully, it means that the focus is on what's unique about this particular place. How are we going to introduce a whole variety of guests and users to celebrate the unique qualities of a particular environment, to really understand and engage with the community, understand and appreciate the history. Perhaps even you start to think about the different groups that show up to a hotel as a family. Maybe the kids are off learning about crops, or maybe they're out doing reptile hunts in the woods, or in the case of Florida, in the Everglades or something like that. And they come back and at the dinner table are sharing all sorts of stories. And in the interim, you know, parents might have gone and had a day at the spa. Maybe the grandparents went to golf, but that multiple generation experience then coming back together at the end of the day is what we're really seeking. So, you know, when we can see all of those different demographics and user groups and things celebrating this, it means that we've got to do our homework. We've got to understand what it is that guest is going to be seeking and start to design really rooted in what's the user experience going to be. The architecture will be a derivative of that. And so if we start with those types of questions, you get wildly different results. So just for your audience, I might share a couple of images just to kind of bring that a little bit to life in terms of the diversity of things that we're doing. Down in Naples is a large scale hotel. On the right hand side of this image is a 220 key Four Seasons hotel. On the left hand side are three residential buildings on the beach. So those are new construction. It has a way of imagining how do you reinvent the one and two story beach cottages that were historically found in Naples. If you reflect even back as far as the late 19th century, arriving to the community by water, coming in on the pier, having gotten on in Tampa and worked your way down the coast. And there's the great community of one and two story cottages that still today are part of the historical district registered with with DC and with Tallahassee in terms of the historic preservation groups. And so in this instance, how do you reinterpret that for five and seven story architecture? But how might you also still come to the beach here in the foreground of the image and have a single story beach-like cottage that actually becomes the restaurant and an experience, not just for the guests and those who choose to live here in the condominiums, but also for the community who can come and continue to celebrate those great life events and those milestone experiences right there next to the setting sun. But you know, at the other end of the spectrum, if you go to Panama and you think about working in an archipelago of islands off the west coast of Panama, you have a very different type of approach where it's delicate rooftops dropped into a really wonderful jungle environment. And then, you know, as you start to think about the diversity of architecture and experiences, you jump up to the panhandle in Florida, up to a place called Alice Beach on 30A, which has a very distinct architecture as a community and ways that we could come in and deliver a different type of beach experience, or perhaps elsewhere in the Lowcountry. You know, something that when you look at this image, you start to think immediately of that continuum of living along the coast between Charleston and Savannah and extending down as far as the Golden Isles, for example, and just inhabiting space differently and using porches and other ways of shedding water and creating shade for different users. And so in each instance, understanding what's unique about a particular place In the case of Sea Island, Addison Meisner over 100 years ago came up to Sea Island working with the Coffin family and said, hey, I've been exploring some things on Worth Avenue and in the Palm Beach area. I'd love to have a chance to deliver the original cloister at Sea Island. We've subsequently come in and introduced additional development that hopefully lives in concert with the work that people who were there ahead of us were able to deliver. And so in each instance, really understanding what's unique about these particular locations and how might we use that experience. I'm going to spend time at this restaurant. So over the course of 2 or 3 hours, what is it that somebody might take away in addition to amazing food from Jean-Georges? What is it that our work as interior designers, as architects, can start to do to create those takeaway moments? And the things that say, I really want to go back, I really learned a lot and want to celebrate time in this particular part of the world, in this case, just east of Charlottesville in Virginia.
Well, as you go through that, Tim, two things came to mind early in your conversation. I think I could summarize your approach to corporate imagery. It seems like those who come to you are really got to understand that the uniqueness and good design and a good analysis of the problem is also good business, that it makes a unique space that is a good business model for them. So I think you're attracting people who have similar business acumen that you do, which is, and that's admirable. The other thing is, as you were showing these images, and so many of them I've never seen of your work, they were amazing. But I've experienced a number of, in my travels, a number of resorts and places that I go to that when I leave, they've imprinted a memory of the specialness of the place or the city that I've been to. So when I think of various places around the world that I visited, I associate them with a place, with a feeling that I had in that place. And you seem to infuse those characteristics into place that are memorable. And as you're showing all of these images, how do you do that? How do you go about infusing something that I'm going to walk away saying, I'm going to remember this for the rest of my life, even if I never come back?
There's, for us, a different starting point. And it's one that I've touched on and on a number of occasions here today. And, imagining what it is that people are going to do here. How are people going to spend time? How might that then work with the things that are unique, whether it's the ecology, the environment of a place, whether it's planning outdoor rooms that complement each interior choice. So one example that comes to mind is the very first meeting that we did for some work we currently have underway at Alice Beach. So I just showed a moment ago an image of the beach club at Alice Beach as one unique example of our work. But deeper into the property, closer to the great forest environment that sits back from the beach along 30A, our first meeting for this next chapter, next phase of Alice Beach, was not that of how do we recreate what's on screen. It's a beautiful environment, and a lot of people have been attracted to spend time here, either buying into the community or just spending a week or 2 weeks here each year. But this next sequence of slides that I'd love to share with you was the very first meeting we did, where we as architects, we as landscape architects, we as interior designers showed up not with the answer about the architecture, but rather with an imaginary story about how a young girl named Alice was going to spend time here. And so in that first aerial image, a lot of the existing homes within Alice Beach are courtyard-based, or the outdoor experiences are using streets to get to a series of gardens. And so it starts here firstly saying, let's think about a different house type. Perhaps that home has a yard around it. It has great sleeping porches that you can see here with shutters. But our sketches started with Alice waking up in her bunk bed. not necessarily thinking about the specifics of the architecture, but imagining how she wakes up, she bounds down the ladder, she runs into the kitchen and has a great pancake breakfast. And where is that breakfast? It's out on the porch. It's the screen porch where mom and dad and the dog are getting organized for the day. And we're starting to think not necessarily about the architecture, although there's some implied thoughts on what that might be. It's about creating a space for that community to come together to start their day. A space where Alice can reach out to her friends and say, hey, it's time to go. Let's grab the dogs and let's head out. Let's go out and see if we can find that bird that we saw yesterday. And so they can leave the home after that great breakfast. They can go along a great street network where we're thinking along with our civil engineers and our landscape architecture team, what's that great safe street solution that we can implement within this community so that the kids or the grandkids can go out and spend time and they can be gone all day and spend their time very safely, while at the same time, mom and dad have that peace of mind, right? They can spend time back at home, clearing the inbox or reading a book, just spending time together, while meanwhile, Alice is off exploring and discovering and finding moments of architecture and site planning where we can start to name and imagine a way that people come together and have things like learning moments on the left where that great bird that you might see in the air, or maybe it's on the ground, you're able to see and learn about it, overlooking, seeing the vegetation, having a moment of shade as you move out of some of these streets. And then you start to see other ways of engaging with the community, whether it's the bridges that move you from point A to point B. And ultimately, those bridges get you to an amenity, an experience, where instead of drawing a pool, we just start to draw a version of how people might come together, whether it's in the fitness type of arrangement in the laps on the prior pool, or kids jumping in and bombing each other in the water. And so we have yet to put pen to paper with scales and say, you know, how big is this pool going to be? It's really starting to evoke emotion and how those family members might come back at the grill and grab a sandwich, or even some guests show up. So now Alice has her grandparents arrive. And so what's that environment? What's that setting? What might they do in the afternoon and the evening as they spend time back here and all the way through to eventually heading to bed? But in this instance, you know, Alice Beach, it's in the name, has a wonderful beach club, a wonderful presence along the white sand of the coast there. But in this instance, we imagined a way of living at Alice Beach without even necessarily having to go to the beach and getting Alice all the way back into her bunk bed. Into the parents' arms. So we started with a storyboard. And that storyboard, of course, in our minds, was keyed into a site plan. So in parallel, we were able to walk our clients through an imaginary day in the life of this particular place. But then it all is rooted in a series of buildings, of landscapes, of experiences that come together to start to then celebrate the unique moments. What is it that we need to draw as specific buildings? What is it that we need to understand? Does the investment make sense? How will it continue to support the requirements of the community? All those different homework that preceded this to say, okay, we need to combine it with a certain number of seats inside of a restaurant that has glazing that can open out for the different times of year, but can also be enclosed and glazed and air conditioned or heated when we need to. And then the ways that an infinity edge pool could engage with the environment here. And of course, over time, those early stage watercolors start to become more rigid computer drawings and ultimately real renderings that start to combine with lighting designer choices and interior designer choices of FF&E. And so that's I think a unique or different way of engaging with our clients that perhaps result in those types of places, Stephen, that you're mentioning, where it was all rooted from the very, very outset in what are those memories somebody's going to take away, and the interaction with friends of their same age, parents, grandparents starting to think about things perhaps a little bit differently than an architect with a capital A who draws buildings for a living.
That is wonderful, because what you've done is planted an emotion and an image and a feeling that then makes it easier to communicate the architecture that will invoke that feeling. Ron and I've had this conversation about storytelling and architects. Every architect in every project has a story. And you started with the story, which is so powerful, so impactful, that story became the basis and the foundation for your architecture. So, you know, we feel that storytelling, we need to tell our story. And architects aren't always good at, you say, communicating. Yes, we can communicate the technical details and the image, but the story behind what we do and how we do it is so important and so impactful, and it makes our product more understandable to the community if they understand that story behind it. So kudos. That's a wonderful example.
Thank you. It's a family who has stewarded that property for a very long time. And I think one of the responsibilities we feel we have is to step in and help to champion those long-term visions and understand what is unique about this place, but perhaps how do we imagine that next chapter of development that really extends that legacy and helps to protect those unique attributes for everybody who might come in the future.
That's wonderful. I have one more question for you. What project in your career do you think has had the most impact on the public and the community that it's located in? And what do you think that impact was?
Great question. And I'm going to admit to some very much some recency bias. I happen to be just off the plane from a wonderful family vacation in sub-Saharan Africa, in East Africa. And it's a place in northern Tanzania called the Grumeti Reserve. It's a property that we as a firm got involved with almost 20 years ago. The original landowner who created this 350,000 acre managed part of that extended the boundaries really of the Serengeti National Park started his work in 2005. We got involved in 2007 and helped to create some relationships between local communities, the TANAPA, the Tanzanian National Parks Authority, as well as then the new landowner, who's an American-based investor and is interested in the preservation and conservation of the ecology and ecosystem of the Serengeti. And so in the context of the recency bias, I went over to see some things that when I was based in London, we started this work in 2007 with large-scale GIS, which is a software that we as architects and planners use. It is a great repository of all sorts of data, whether it's about the natural conditions on a piece of land, so the slope and shape of a piece of topography and land, or water and stormwater and rainwater. It also includes the GIS database includes population and other statistics, but it's a wonderful resource where we were able to, in the first instance, get our hands around what's unique about this place, to engage with, in that instance, the Frankfurt Zoological Society, to understand what are the existing bio corridors, the migratory patterns, recognizing that it's part of the great migration of wildebeest. But how might we then ultimately use hospitality and development to help fund in perpetuity the preservation and protection of this land? And so we got involved firstly as master planners. We then complemented that role with some strategic thinking that helped to create some of these relationships between different players. But then we executed on some architecture within that context to say, how might we host people here? how might the revenue associated with somebody coming to pay to stay here be used to fund anti-poaching programs, be used to fund the research into how do we protect rhino and the genes and DNAs? How might we rehabilitate rhino? I was being there a couple of weeks ago. There's a rhino, for example, that was relocated from the San Diego Zoo. It had kind of exhausted its life in San Diego, and it needed to be rehabilitated, rehabituated into the natural environment. And so they're slowly working their way through that. They've done it successfully with 11 rhino thus far, and they have another couple underway, slowly introducing them back to the wildlife and the rhythms of weather over the course of the year, recognizing how cyclical it is before they ultimately move them out into the park. And so all of that is a direct result of finding that right location where we could introduce an architectural assignment and work as landscape architects and architects and interior designers to deliver those experiences. So of course, there's the amazing value that's reflected in the wildlife and in the place. In the case of Tanzania, they're very much focused on the highest end, basically saying we can employ just as many people, but perhaps with less of an impact relative to the amount of guests that need to come, because we can charge more. And so there's different philosophies as you look all over East Africa in terms of attracting the tourism dollar. But one of the Tanzanian solutions is to focus on fewer visitors at a higher end. And then ultimately that real revenue totals a sum that can protect and preserve some of those experiences. So just to kind of put a little bit of imagery alongside that, it's a very small scale hotel in this instance. So while on the one hand, we looked at some images earlier of things as large as Naples, in this instance, you're down in that 20 to 30 room environment. And so you see a central lodge with a number of separate accommodations that once that sun goes through, you're actually being escorted by a security guard because there's no fences between you and the wildlife. So if they decide that they need to eat, if a giraffe needs to eat a particular acacia tree, they're going to be right outside the front door when you go to get into your safari truck. But towards the top end of this screen, there's a small little construction site in the top center of the screen, which came out of some analyses that I mentioned with all of these different data sets, whether it's working with the Frankfurt Zoo and Tanapa or other partners, but ultimately then imagining a home that could occupy that location. And so now we can attract a larger multi-generational family visitor who can come and spend a week here, going out on game drives in the morning and in the evening, but during the course of the rest of their day, spending time here. So we're able to deliver to them the pool and the different experiences. Thinking very smartly about resource management. So how many times might we be able to use a drop of water, for example? And so we harvest all of the rainwater. We're able to use the green roofs that you see reflected here on screen as ways of actually filtering some of that water and recapturing it after it goes through a wetland system that we built on the roof so that we can reuse it in places like toilets and other locations in the home. And so you get an experience as a guest like this, where in the evening you might come down and have this great view out to sunset, but earlier in the day you were up at the pool or you headed out onto your game drive. So that was one home, it's called Kilima. And then just 18 months ago, we finished up on construction with a number of different development partners from both the Grumetti Fund as well as the Milton Group. Working as their concept architect here to deliver the most recent property called Malele. So it came out of some of those early sketches. You can see here in the bottom right that sketch is much more about the table. It consumes a huge amount of the image, and then the architecture is implied. But it's that way of working consistently to say, when I step out of my front door and I hop into my game drive truck, what's that environment? How does the tree canopy come over and create that shade in the heat of the day? So that ultimately you get these types of vistas and experiences as you walk in the front door, have that big view across the Serengeti Plains. But in the evening, as the temperatures drop into the 50s, you're able to have that roaring fire here to welcome you home, or the next morning before you head out on your game drive to sit up in bed and have that great view out across the savannah. So, you know, that interaction with marrying together hotel experiences, the development thesis, the ability to support poaching, the ability to fund community education programs where you're able to take kids after school programs and share with them why this ecology, why the Serengeti is so important, and perhaps therefore why they need to work with their families to protect it. And so I think it's definitely a bit of recency bias, but it's consistent with how we as a firm have worked, and it's rooted in this aspiration of stewardship. So whether we're stewarding people's careers who choose to join us and thinking about how they're learning, how they can ultimately be that fourth and fifth generation of our firm ownership, a firm that dates back to 1967, and how they might continue to attract clients who think about that long-term set of outcomes.
Well, what that example, when I asked you what was the most impactful aspect of a project, I think the impact here is no impact, minimal impact. It's reverse, which is so impressive. And I've been to that area of Tanzania, and it's just absolutely wonderful what you're doing there and how you're integrating it. So
it's a massive team, just to be crystal clear. We have but a very small role in it. I think it's a really important you know, we start to think about the long term of international funding and how governments around the world are prioritizing investments, and these natural resources are things that that we all, I think, collectively need to think about. Whether it's designing a building for the middle of a city, let's see what we can do to reduce its energy. Let's see what we can do to reduce its embodied carbon. Let's be as smart as we can. And take advantage of the building science that's out there to say we know how to build smarter. And I think we can each do our role, our part in this larger conversation of design and thinking about placemaking.
Well, Tim, I've really enjoyed this conversation. And actually, even though I've known you for some time, I've learned a lot more about you and your firm in this conversation. Really enjoyed it. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you, Tim, for sharing such incredible examples of how architects can have, you know, lifelong impact on a community through thoughtful, intentional design of place. I've appreciated how you reminded us of our role as communicators. I hope our listeners learned something new from Tim's explanation of their process. And don't forget to follow our podcast so you won't miss an upcoming session of Architecture and You. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Voice of Florida Architecture, a podcast of AIA Florida.